The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to We the People with Aaron Ryan.
Beau Cundiff.
Bob Martin.
And Ray Halp, our guest.
Thank you.
Who will ultimately speak. We just sort of ran in the door, so it's like, here, throw these headphones on and we're going to do a show. Oh my gosh. So today, we're going to talk about...
Well, I thought we'd talk about public lands in general, maybe from the beginning to present, and what's not working as intended.
Yeah, I think everybody knows the part about not working, but I think they would be interested to know how we got to not working.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, because, you know, sometimes it's not exactly what everybody thinks. And sometimes the fix isn't what we think either.
That's true.
So it's worth digging in a little bit. Bill's manning the chat room. He's not allowed to talk while he types.
I'm not good at multitasking.
He's over here. He's all.
I'm guilty. I think the forest hasn't been managed correctly for a long time. I think we can all pretty much agree to that. And it's really a mess right now. When you go up and, you know, you drive through the woods today, it's a marked difference between Forest Service land and private land. Just look at the ground. I mean, you can tell just by looking at it.
Yeah, it's a mess.
What's what?
Yeah, a lot of the forested land is at risk if you're next to National Forest right now.
Yeah, that's true. If you have property that adjoins,
yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
welcome to the next catastrophic fire.
Exactly. You're parked next to a firebomb. Yeah,
or beetle impact or something.
Yep. Some other horrible thing.
Yeah, let's talk about that, too, because I've been seeing quite a bit of that lately, and I'm kind of curious what's happening
there.
Sure. So
give people your background so that they know we're not just, see, Bill and I will be just making things up. Ray will actually be a delivering fact. We're just here for the comic relief.
Well, the bulk of my career has been working mostly on the West Coast. I spent a little bit of time on the East Coast. I retired in 2010 from the U.S. Forest Service. I was a district ranger when I retired. Prior to that, the first two-thirds of my career was as a forester. And, after that, I decided to, do something different because National Forests were going in a different direction than what I grew up to believe. And, we were just kind of losing it and losing the public focus.
So you started when? 80-something?
No, I started in 1976.
Oh, 70-something.
Yeah.
And you were what? Was that your beginning career? Were you a 20-something at that point?
I was 22, I think. 21, 22 years
so
old.
So you really did do that your whole,
yeah,
like your whole
professional
career? Well,
I was in private doing things before that. Not private forestry, but retail and those
kind
of things.
All the stuff we all do.
Yeah, all the stuff to get through school.
Can you really tell? I mean, when you look at the forest today versus when you first got started, I mean, and can you tell the difference?
Oh, dramatically different. And that's the thing that most people don't understand is that, when some of us who've been around that long and have worked off and on in the same place, in the early part of my career, I was working, putting the roads in, developing the forest for harvest, that kind of thing, and doing a lot of assessment work of really what was out there in a lot of the forested land that really hadn't had a lot of people walking on it before.
And you were making it accessible.
Yeah.
Unlike now,
yeah,
where we're making it unaccessible.
Yeah, doing all the data collection and that kind of thing, inventories.
Sure.
And I can tell you from personal experience, it's just dramatically different today, mm-hmm, than it was then.
Interesting. And now, you retired as the district ranger.
As a district ranger, yeah.
In the area where now you're the county supervisor.
That's correct.
Yeah, so that's kind of a fun viewpoint, I guess.
Well,
and you live,
yeah,
there, too. So.
Yeah, I do. Well, it's kind of a natural progression. I mean, some people kind of think that politics and ranger are kind of different, but they're really the same. You work with the same communities, same issues, mm-hmm, those kind of things. And I couldn't stand sitting around and not using the talent I had for the community.
Well, besides, everybody kept, mm-hmm, calling. Hey, what's he's my go-to guy. What does this mean? What are they talking about?
Yeah. Well, so, I taught for 4 years at the community college that College
of Siskiyous.
Oh, that's
right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, and we, you know, we had a pretty good forestry program going there for a little bit of time. Then, of course, like all grants, you know, they end, and so did the program.
Oh.
You know, and so, you know, I did a little bit of consulting on the side as an RPF and wrote some, I guess some position papers, I guess, for counties, Modoc County for sage grouse and some of the other habitat things they were confronted with. And then just seemed natural that get engaged. And, you know, politics kind of got us into this. And science isn't going to get us out. And I think politics is going to get us back, hopefully, to some kind of...
As long as everybody doesn't just throw up their hands and walk away.
Well, that's true.
I mean, that's not one of the choices at this point is, it's too hard, it's too far gone, there's nothing we can do, throw in the towel and walk away.
Well, and that's part of the part of the American consciousness. And, you know, just like history and any other thing, the reason I wanted to come in and talk today is that I really don't think most people understand... the relationship between counties and their public lands, and how we got to this point, and what was the design? Believe it or not, there was kind of a master design.
There was
design
a plan. Oh my
in
gosh!
All this, not the current mess we see ourselves in.
Okay, so where do you want to start?
How about 1890?
Okay. I'm like,
let's go to the beginning.
Hold on. Last night we watched How the West Was Won. Was that the Debbie Reynolds era?
Well, it's really important. If you look back at that time, there was a lot of same kind of turmoil about what to do with natural resources going on in our Congress. And it was a debate between Gifford Pinchot and John Muir at the time.
Oh.
And between the two of them, they couldn't come to grips with what public land should be. You know, should it be hands off, which was John Muir, or should it be wise use, which was Gifford Pinchot? So in a conference in 1890, the two parties thought they struck a reasonable compromise, and the Park Service was actually formed for the preservation of lands under John Muir's philosophy. And Gifford Pinchot led the Forest Service, U.S. Forest Service.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So it was formed for preservation, but it was initially run by a guy who thought we should use it.
Yes, yes. And, you know, Gifford Pinchot at the time actually brought forestry to the United States. Prior to that, it was only being practiced in Europe. And he formed the Yale Forestry School. And as such, started modern forestry and forest science in the United States. But part of that, which is really important, is the Forest Service is the only agency that's been concocted that I'm aware of in the federal government that actually has a research branch to support the work that it does.
Really?
And that was from the very beginning, yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Where are they? Back in Washington?
Actually, they're scattered all over the country. There's one right here in Redding.
Really?
Yeah.
What are they called?
Pacific Northwest Research Station.
And that's a Forest Service thing?
That's a Forest Service station, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so back in the day when you first got started,
mm-hmm.
my guess is they were a lot more active? Or had a lot more say, maybe?
Well, the laws were clearer. I'll put it that way. And the agency enjoyed a great deal of public trust and support at that point in time, and you know, the agency was practicing some fairly reasonable forestry in the 60s and 70s, though it had not embraced yet the new science of forest ecology. And that was kind of a transitional period in the 70s into the 80s with all of the various acts that everybody hears about, the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act and the National Environmental Policy Act of the early 70s that came into being. Also really important at that point in time was that nobody really knew too much about what the government was doing. And as a result of that, I kind of theorized the suspicions of the 60s. The National Environmental Policy Act was put into place to publicly disclose, not to conduct science experiments like it is today, but to publicly disclose what the government was actually doing with their projects.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that'd be nice to know.
Yeah, it was a public disclosure law, not a massive scientific undertaking.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Okay, so who wrote it and what happened to it?
Well, it was hijacked by the courts pretty quickly, and the emphasis
changed. Should have seen that one coming.
Yeah, I can see. You know, in my early years, The environmental assessment took us about 3 months to complete. They were maybe 25 pages at the most, which was the intent. And today we see them taking 2 years and often 600 pages, and something that was fairly minimal cost is now into the millions. The same magnitude of what we were doing, and is actually much less.
And what do you count the increased cost to? I mean, is it just more bureaucracy,
more layers, more layers of trying to protect against lawsuit?
Right.
Yeah, that's a big topic today.
So
lawsuit
nothing's
thing.
Going into land development or preservation. It's all going into administrative.
Sure. Well, they all want wilderness area. I do know that because they're constantly hitting up the congressional districts. You know, well, we don't have enough wilderness area.
Yeah.
And there's quite a push there now.
But I have to go back to the original premise.
You hold know, that thought.
That we first
hold the original premise.
I'll do that.
In conjunction with the whole beginning of our day here, we're 5 minutes late for our break.
It's going to put us back on track. We'll be heroes.
This isn't good. Bob, you're going to have to flag me. All righty. You're listening to We the People Radio. We're here with Ray Haupt. We're talking about the Forest Service history, sort of, and how we got to where we are with our public lands. We're talking about public lands. Yeah, that's better than Forest Service.
Yeah.
And Bill's here, too.
Yeah.
And Bob. We'll be right back. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
What should we do about them? What do they want? What should we do about them? What do they want?
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
You're going to make us laugh, aren't you, Bob?
Got to try.
Yeah, what a great topic for all of this. So we're speaking with Ray Haupt this morning on forest lands and what's going on with those. And actually, we'll talk about monuments, too. We were talking about that on the break. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. The chat room is alive and well. Hello to everybody in there. And, okay, so... So, fast forward to the monument thing. They just designated one where in Mendocino, on the Mendocino Forest.
Right.
Just so happens it's where all the major pot growing is happening.
Yeah, and a lot of other activity on that landscape. But
so now that it's a monument,
yes,
that means nobody gets to go on it.
Well, there'll be a monument. Management plan put in place, so to speak. Some of them, you know, they vary. They vary from near wilderness to a lot of recreation kind of things. One of the ones that the Clinton administration did in the sequoia for the preservation of the giant sequoia trees is actively managed, just not allowed to produce a commercial product anymore.
What's the difference between a wilderness designation and a monument designation?
Well, wilderness is designated by Congress, so there is a vote on it, and it is reserved and set aside. The first Wilderness Act was 1964 in the Wilderness Act, and that was it kind of rolled a lot of lands in from 1935 primitive designation that was in place at that time. Largely lands that were pristine and needed to be held in higher protection, so to speak, not just kind of general landscape.
So no mechanized anything in a wilderness area?
Not unless it was historically part of the operation of that part of the land. So you will find some wilderness that allow mechanization to a limited degree.
But that's also true for a monument, correct?
A monument can be just about anything that goes into the monument plan.
Oh, okay. So each one can be different.
Yeah, the difference is that Congress designates what's allowed and what's not allowed under wilderness management, but the executive branch solely does the monument piece.
Which makes it not part of the people's will.
No, which makes it sort of it just drops on the landscape and then you're stuck with it.
And it preempts what we were talking about earlier with the whole development period or early on in the United States was predicated on these public domain lands being productive. And they were to be productive for the rural economy and also for the tax base because, of course, counties cannot tax public lands. And so the portion of the receipts that come off those lands were to supply the tax revenues for roads and schools in support of rural California as well as the rural West.
All right, so you were talking about, tell folks what you were telling us during the break. We shouldn't talk during the break because what happens is then we don't actually talk about it on the air. Like, oh, yeah, we already talked about that. Okay, so how we have swung politically and why.
Well, it's kind of interesting, you know, sitting in the agency and watching the different administrations come and go. The agency was largely disconnected politically, at least at the field level, until really the Reagan administration. And but Reagan was faced with a lot of the same issues we face today with unemployment and expanding deficits and those kinds of things, crashed economy. And rather than borrow money, the Reagan administration chose to increase the harvest on public lands to pay off the debt.
What a novel idea.
Yeah.
Because they are a resource.
Yeah. A lot of us, including myself, didn't think that was too smart, you know, to the extent that he did that. We went into something called departure, which means we were cutting above what the growth was on national forest for a short period of time. That's okay as long as you back it down after that. That gets at the heart of what is sustained yield and those kinds of things off those lands. But as a reversal of that, the Clinton administration came in and put a lot of things in place that pretty much nullified began to nullify the active management on public lands. And that hasn't reversed itself. And those swings have taken place over the history, the 100-year-plus history of the agency's you know, historically.
So that's where the management part of it started to kind of slip a little bit, and we started getting the fuels build up and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and that's when we had a lot of litigation begin. There was litigation before, but not near the intensity.
From the environmental groups?
Environmental groups, you know, industry once in a while, but mostly environmental groups.
When did they start getting paid to sue?
That's an interesting dance because Reagan actually Equal Access to Justice Act, yes, but it had a sunset date on it, and it was limited. It was initially for, as my understanding is, for small business to be able to address their grievances against a very large bureaucracies at the time,
which is a good idea.
Yeah,
like all things that have been abused, started out as a good idea.
Yeah, started out as a good idea. It sunsetted.
When was that? When did it sunset?
It had a 5-year life expectancy. The late 80s, I'm not sure exactly the date. It sunsetted the first time, and then it was picked up by the first Bush administration and reauthorized for, I believe, about a 2-year period.
And what was their thought behind it? Same idea?
Same idea.
Okay.
Same idea, some things going on that people couldn't afford to address their government over issues they were having. And a lot of this was not Forest Service kind of things. These were small business association things and,
sure.
You know, regarding, you know, business enterprise and those kinds of things. And then
the environmental guys were like, hey.
Yeah, well, Bill Clinton then reauthorized it. And I guess it's, I don't know, with an executive order, I guess it's permanent now. But expanded it greatly to include non-governmental organizations,
right.
and others. And you'll see in 19, if you look at the records, you'll see a dramatic increase in litigation beginning about 1993-1994.
Interesting. And so once that started, once the environmental group, and so for people who say live in an area that doesn't have forest or they haven't been involved in that,
uh-huh.
Why would environmental groups sue the forest?
Well, because they're repaid for doing that. And you know, all of us.
But what's the premise of their suit?
Well, even for, I mean, we have the term environmentalist. I like to say the conflict industry mainly because there
sounds so much nicer than enviro-Nazi.
Well, there is an industry around sue and settle and, mm-hmm. and sue for money and sue for profit and that kind of thing.
So that gives you more money to sue for other things.
Yeah, and I'd like to think that this is only from environmental groups, but it's not. You know, I mean, this is government wide. So each bureaucracy has their own ambulance chaser.
Sure, well, look what happened with ADA, right?
Yeah.
You have the guy out there measuring, oh, you're a quarter of an inch off on your ramp, you know.
Sure.
Take them to the cleaners. Well, these guys initially started going after the Forest Service. I mean, now I know what they go after them for. Mm-hmm. You have a huge fire, and they want to cut some of the down, you know, the dead and dying timber or what's still left on the landscape. They want to harvest some of that while it's usable, and they sue them for that to mm-hmm. stop those projects.
Sure.
Back in the day, what were they suing them for?
Well, when it first started, I was personally dealing with some groups that were anti-commercial activity on public lands.
Oh, okay.
And that was their premise. Stop all commercial activity on public lands because, after all, they belong to the public and no one should get a special deal off operating on public lands.
So no harvesting of trees on public land because whoever was doing it, timber company, was making money.
Some timber company makes money off that, yes.
Well, doesn't the money... the timber company makes money, but if it's public lands, the sale of that product goes back into the coffers, correct?
That's right.
Now, what is the current mindset? I mean, why don't they go in and harvest, burn timber? In a lot of cases, they just let it stand until it's too old to harvest, mm-hmm. and then you get bugs, you get everything else, and it makes it very difficult for the forest to really come back and reseed itself. Why don't they go in and clean it up? What's the mindset there?
Well, it's not really a mindset. It's a legal framework. And if you look at the, like I say, since 1993, there's been a lot of precedent set in the administrative record on some of these court cases that increase the process. So constantly the agency is struggling to meet a new legal hurdle that it hadn't anticipated when it started a project. And it's not only legal hurdles against the agency itself, but now have the Endangered Species Act. So there's legal challenges to that agency as well that has to give its concurrence on land activities. And then you have the Council on Environmental Quality out of the President's office who oversees the National
Environmental Policy. So it has to go through all these maneuvers before they can actually go in and start cutting trees by that time.
Yeah.
You know, the government moves so quickly.
lightning speed.
Yeah, lightning speed. Three years later, you have, great, go in and cut all this dead, rotten wood down. And
which is either physically impossible or economically impossible.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a shame.
Which is crazy.
I know, because you look at how much, I mean, look at the size of some of these fires we're having now, and some of them, granted, are too hot, and there really isn't much to harvest, but a lot of these fires are fast-moving fires, tons of timber still standing there that's harvestable, and it just goes to waste.
Yeah, what concerns me more than anything else is the loss of forested cover.
Exactly.
And, you know, I'm not happy personally with looking out my backyard and looking at snags and brush. I'd much rather see trees.
Sure, sure.
Mm-hmm.
And when they go in and cut that, they replant it.
Well, it's required under law.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I had somebody trying to convince me the other day that we go in and we're cutting all the trees down and then we're just left with brush. They don't replant. And then when they do replant, they only plant one species, and so it all... You know, it's not the real forest. I mean, people really don't have
so what's the rule?
Information.
Well, that's an interesting argument. If you were making that argument in 1980, I'd agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're fighting in the forest industry right now. We're fighting the wars of 1970, 1980, thinking that the technology and the research hasn't changed since.
Right. Well, when I came up here in the mid to late 80s, you know, we had the Fountain Fire, which was probably one of the biggest ones we had. That was kind of the beginning of the huge fires. And you go up there now where that's mostly been replanted, and there's a variety of trees in there. And in fact, they're at the age now where they probably going to start thinking about going in and start thinning them out. I mean, it's that.
Yeah, if you look at the progression, I guess, of forestry as a science itself, mm-hmm. You'll see that prior to about 1975, you know, forest ecology didn't exist. And so what the foresters were practicing was something called administrative forestry, which was basically everything reduced to numbers.
Oh.
You know, you can grow this much per acre, and if you do this, you can do that. It was more like a cornfield kind of thing. My class was one of the first classes actually to have forest ecology as part of the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't make a lot of sense to me when I went to work either. I mean, why would you reforest an area with Douglas fir instead of ponderosa pine when ponderosa pine came off of that
right.
acre? But yet that's what was being done because that was the highest value product with the fastest growth. So and that's all changed.
Hmm. Well, that's good.
Well, we have to promise our listeners that we're going to get to the how do we change from a fire industry back to a resource industry? that is the burning question, if you'll pardon the pun.
It is the burning question. There's a lot of money around
and,
that.
And yeah, so we'll talk about that some more when we come back. You're listening to We the People Radio. We are speaking with Ray Haupt, 30 years with the Forest Service, and now he's a county supervisor in the place where he was a district ranger. So we're getting a really nice, plus he doesn't use notes because he remembers everything he ever reads. It's super handy. We brought in the Forest Dictionary, encyclopedia.
If you want to drive a big limousine, I'll buy the longest one you've ever seen. I'll buy you tall, tall trees and all the waters in the seas. I'm a fool, fool, fool for you.
And it's whispered that soon, if we all call the tune, then the piper will lead us to reason. And a new day will dawn for those who stand long, and the forest will echo with laughter.
Instead of crackle with fire. Thanks, Bob.
Hey, it's a break. We were talking about the fountain fire again, and you know, I came up here in the mid late '80s, and at that time, that was like one of the biggest fires we'd had up here, and everybody was really shocked. But
what was that 89, 90? I think it was right when I moved.
Yeah,
I moved.
About 1987. I was gone 3 weeks that year on a fire team.
Yeah.
Well, your response was the Forest Service was started because of
bigger fires.
Yeah, lots bigger fires. Back in the 1700s, 1800s, there were fires that, you know, spanned 10 years and three states.
They burned for 10 years?
Yeah. Yeah.
Shit.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So I guess we're complaining about nothing then.
You know,
sorry.
Well, they were largely unabated, you know, because
we didn't have the crews. We didn't have the resources.
How would you even get there?
Stop them.
Yeah. A lot of it was, you know, undeveloped land and just went on and on and on.
Yikes. So,
and then the fires of 1910 were large fires in the Pacific Northwest you know, the Pulaski incident and all those things at those time, Ranger Pulaski. That's a whole show in itself. But
why would he do or not do?
He held his Ranger district at gunpoint in a mine to protect them from the fire.
Oh, you're kidding me. Well, that's a problem.
Whoopsie.
But he saved their lives, you know.
At gunpoint.
Yeah, at gunpoint.
Ironic.
Yeah, there's some interesting stuff out there.
Wow.
Never heard that one.
They did have a lot more local control back then, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, the Pulaski tool is named after him.
I wondered about that. Yeah. I thought that was kind of an interesting coincidence. Okay, yeah. That answered my looming question. Okay, so the Clinton era made tons of changes.
Yes.
All right, give us we were talking on the break, like, you know, give us the, you know, like what?
Where do you want to start?
I don't, well, you know, because the reason I say this is these same players actually are looming for next year.
Mm-hmm.
So if, in fact, we go back to that, for all those people who think that, you know, this is going to be great, what do we have to look forward to? What did your husband do?
Well, I was, you know, I was trained by World War II veterans, basically, who really knew what public service was. So that's where my public service...
Because they were the greatest generation for
reason. And that's where my ethic comes from. The newer generation of folks working for the agency, I don't think really quite understand what they knew and what they imparted on, say, my generation. But there was a call within the agency by that administration at that time that the agency was filled with a bunch of dinosaurs, and they needed to retire. You know, and that was the first call. And there were giants. Hal Salwasser, dean of forestry at OSU, was one of them at that period of time. A whole raft of people left the agency at the time and pretty much drained the corporate memory right out of it. Between about 1993 and about 1997. Along with that, you know, because of the Paperless Reduction Act, 100 years worth of manuals were gotten rid of out of the agency. And they were the corporate knowledge of how to do things.
Exactly. There's your history.
What do you mean they got rid of them?
What worked and
like
what didn't work.
Like they threw them away?
Yeah.
Well, that's super smart.
Well, they knew it all. Yeah. Yeah. That was all.
They knew people who knew everything.
It was old stuff.
It was old technology.
Old stuff. You know, but there was a cookbook on how to do anything in the forest. It was kind of interesting. Some of it was a little antiquated. You had to kind of infiltrate your new science into it and that kind of thing. But the mechanical things,
the
mathematical things, the blueprint was good. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Okay. So they get rid of all the old guys. They get rid of all the tried and true stuff.
Yeah.
It's been going on for years and years and years.
And beginning with, my name's the chief after.
It's okay. You could say anybody.
Mike Dombeck.
Okay.
Was actually the first politically appointed chief of the Forest Service. That was visibly, I mean, they've all been political, but the first visible appointee of the agency. You really didn't know, you know, a lot about the nuts and bolts of the agency. Kind of come up on the recreation side of things, and a departure from the we can get it done kind of attitude in the agency. That with that, there were dramatic changes in the National Forest System management at the Washington level. A reversal of a thought process in the past that meant, you know, we serve the public and therefore all the resources should go to the field first. Mm. And that should be always funded first and should be the highest priority to a new paradigm now where the Washington office dramatically grew.
Became an entity of its own.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lovely.
And I worked for an old timer who said, today, I've just seen the agency go from public serving to self-serving. And
They took all the budgeting?
And he was probably right, too.
Yeah. Well, the budget began to migrate itself upward. The Office of Management and Budget kept giving the agency unclean bills of health, so to speak, with their budgeting, even though at the field level, I knew every dime that was spent and where it was going.
And so your job back then was to make sure they harvested timber on your area of responsibility, and that was used to do things on your forest,
yes,
right?
And a justification for every dime that was spent. I had spreadsheets to keep track of the public trust funds. We started to migrate then toward something called a unified budget.
Mm.
And
the old one-size-fits-all that never really does.
Yeah. We all of a sudden got clean budgets, but nobody knew where the money was going. And somebody may have. But the authorities to spend money were taken from the ranger districts and migrated upwards so that all the ranger districts have is a spreadsheet with a number of days on it to spend in projects. And so an agency that served the public prior to that by moving funds around to meet local need all of a sudden became a 1 or 2 year process to get something done because there was no flexibility, so to speak, at the field level to address emerging issues. That in itself added a lot of time to processes, and that's one of the things I think that the public, well, I know the public doesn't know that about the budget process.
Right.
But that's the one thing that decoupled the local folks from being able to get the agency to do things they thought were important.
Well, and along with that, you had, because that was about that same time, right, when if you had a fire, you had to actually calculate the cost of the public land timber that was that was lost in the fire.
Yeah, we had to do that until about, my memory's fading a little bit, but around 1999 is when the total fire cost, including the resource loss, remained part of the reporting process. It's no longer there.
So really, all the accountability, I guess.
That's what it is.
Because that really is the bottom line is the accountability was on the ground. It was local. And the people in that area could actually probably affect it.
Yeah, and the agency was, prior to 2000, was largely decentralized, with decentralized decision making, and that's what its strength was.
And so if you had a bad guy at the helm in your area, it didn't take down the whole thing.
No, you just moved him.
You just got rid of that guy.
Yeah, and that was frequent. I mean,
I'm sure
the ranger was kind of like a political appointee, served at the will of whoever, and they were moved all over the place, for whatever activity that wasn't according to Hoyle.
Yeah, it's like, that's not good.
Yeah.
Off he goes.
All of a sudden, you're not in Fort Jones anymore. You're in San Francisco in the regional office.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we're going to get you away from the public because you're making everybody angry.
Yeah.
And the resource base at that time then funded the schools and...
Yeah, well, that actually, the high point for like Siskiyou County was 1988, I believe, about $8.5 million in deposits to roads and schools in that county.
And how was that for folks who don't follow this kind of thing? How was that generated?
It was generated off a percentage of the receipts off of the timber that was sold.
Okay, yeah, so if your county was largely forest land, because now that's a huge impediment.
Right.
Counties like Trinity and Siskiyou and a lot of these places that are largely public land, now there's no benefit to them.
It's
just a resource they don't get.
It's a burden.
Yeah.
It's both a tax burden, it's a burden on whether or not you could have a strong economy in the future. Because one thing you have to remember is that the Clinton administration, because of the Northwest Forest Plan, put something in place, payments to states, which was a payment in lieu of the timber harvest at a historic level. And from working with Congress that's been a struggle to keep getting that reauthorized. Well, that's set on those receipts that were taken in 1988, but it continues to go downward. And the whole
and now they think it's like, now they treat it like it's welfare.
Right.
Now we're doling out money to these guys because we're really nice now.
It was to replace the collapse of the industry under the Northwest Forest Plan in 1993. And, it was only to be there for a 10-year period because after 10 years everything was going to be nirvana again, and it continues to go downhill. But the one thing I want to say most about that, though, is that you can give something out in a welfare payment, but it doesn't have a multiplicative effect in the economy.
Right.
You know, it goes to a few teachers and a few workers at the county level. But if you had the actual receipts generating those dollars in the timber industry like it were before, then you have a 15 times multiplier.
Because you had real people working in the woods
and
hauling the...
And that whole piece is missing.
Which is why it feels like all the rural counties are just poor.
Which is why Siskiyou County used to be one of the richest counties in the state of California, and now it's third from the bottom.
Wow. And so unnecessary because the resource is there, and actually it's...
Actually, there's...
I mean, what do you have?
We have more trees now than when the agency first was put into practice.
So that whole idea that we've cut all the trees down...
No, the research I've been doing just in Siskiyou Mountains, like I said, from the with the Sugar Creek research I've been doing, we're four times the wood fiber density per acre than we were in 1930.
Wow. So if we cut a few of them, we'd be all right.
I don't think you'd miss them.
Yeah, I think we'd be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But burning them up is so much more fun.
Yeah.
No. We have NEPA questions, the National Environmental Policy Act questions in here, and... We've got a lot of stuff to talk about, folks. We just have a lot. So you're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us, and we'll be right back.
You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
It took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. And they charge the people a dollar and a half just to see them.
That's the Park Service, yeah.
That you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Welcome back. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Okay, so we have a whole nother hour with you, but in this last 4 minutes, give us some numbers on the forest in your area, just from what's happened since they've stopped cutting and gone into this weird preservation thing.
Well, I can tell you the biological potential of the Klamath National Forest is about 600 million board feet a year. And that's
not cutting the whole forest down.
That's what's grown every year on that forest outside of wilderness designation. That is the net volume growth. The gross is 800 and some. So that would include the occasional bug infestation, the trees just dying because of old age, that kind of thing. So in the heyday, so to speak, in the 80s, the Klamath National Forest was producing on the market about 200 to 250 million board feet annually. That was departure. You know, it was a little too strong because you have to understand that not everything in growth goes directly into growth. You know, some of
sure.
it, yeah, there's tree competition, those kinds of things that slow things down. So, but certainly anything around 150 would certainly be sustained on that landscape. Today, the Klamath struggles. The Northwest Forest Plan says it should be producing 55 million board feet a year.
I'm frightened to ask, what's it producing?
It struggles to get out 20.
Wow.
20 million.
And 55 sounds kind of low to me.
55 is so low that, it's barely enough to keep an industry alive.
Right, right. That's not enough to even go in there. And
so what's that do to the water?
Well, interesting enough, if you want to check that out, look at the research that Dr. Roger Bales is doing in the Sierra Nevada with the Sierra Nevada Consortium and the research folks down there. I'm also working with Roger Bales in Siskiyou County in the Sugar Creek Project. And you can find that report on Northern California Resource Center webpage. And there's a link to the Sugar Creek Project there.
Nice. I'll link that on the website.
Yeah. What we see is twofold with forest densities. One, we chose to model forest water yields from 1930 to present, and then projecting into the future with the current management that's occurring. Now, this study occurs both on private and public lands. So private lands are a little different. They're highly managed, but they're also a little dysfunctional as well. We've seen since 1930 about four times the density of wood that's been there historically, and that's cessation of fire from both Native American burning and settler grazing burning, as well as lack of harvest, and a shift from ponderous pine that was predominantly in the landscape that doesn't use a whole lot of water to true fir.
And is this private land you're talking about?
Both in the public and the private. It's more prevalent on the public land. Higher densities, higher tree densities.
And that's the dysfunctional part you're talking
about?
Well,
the dysfunctional part is that it leads to large fire behavior because there aren't any holes in it like historically there were.
Like meadows?
Yeah, like meadows. And actually, Eric Knapp's research in the Sierra says 25% of the landscape was in early seral across that
we're
going
to do more of this when we come back. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Welcome to We the People Radio. You're joining us in our second hour. you want to hear the first hour, you'll have to just go listen to the archive, because we can't possibly do that all over for you.
Thank goodness.
You'll find Yeah, by the way, hey, Ray, were you taking notes? Like, could you do that over again? We've got that for you at wethepeopleradio.us. And tons of archives stretching back to October of 2010, believe it or not. We've covered all sorts of stuff. And, you know, I guess we should announce that if you have any ideas of programs or people or, you know, authors you've read or interviews you've heard and you'd like to hear more, shoot us a message. Go to wethepeopleradio.us and you'll find our phone numbers and, what do you call them, email addresses.
Email.
Yeah, if you want to prank call anybody, prank call Bill.
Yeah, I'm good at prank calls. I'll return them as soon as I can.
I get enough of those at work. Bill's the one starved for phone calls. All righty. So we're here with Ray Haupt. Give us a little snapshot on your bio, Ray. It's always better if you do it than if I do it.
Okay. 33 years with the U.S. Forest Service. Forester by training. Went to school at Cal Poly.
I did not know that.
In San Luis Obispo. Also attended Humboldt State.
Me too.
Hey,
this is proof, you know, that like intelligent conservative people could go to Humboldt State.
There you go.
Go figure.
But I was only there a short period of time.
I was there a while.
I was studying logging engineering and economics. So you
were actually there getting an education.
Yeah.
I was an English major and I was busy goofing off.
And then taught school for 4 years in the forestry program, and at the community college, it was College of Siskiyous and Weed, and transferable program to Humboldt into forestry. And I don't know.
And now you're the elected county supervisor.
Yeah.
Dun, da, da, yeah. Da, 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 da. And people are really happy about that. I guess we should point that out. You know, a lot of our elected officials, you know, people are like, oh, all elected officials are bad. We need to get rid of everyone. Well, I'll tell you what, the people up there, if they tried to get rid of you, those guys would take them.
They'd have a revolt.
They would. They'd have a revolt. They're pretty happy about it.
Pitchforks and torches there. Yeah.
Yeah, which is really weird because usually it's the other way.
Yeah.
But no, they're really happy. Somebody actually likes them, cares about them, and has information that can help them. What a good combination.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're all about our whole county is centered around natural resources. So,
or the overabundance thereof and the inability to use.
That's correct.
Which is super frustrating. So, okay, talk to us some more about the Clintons. What did they do to the, I don't know, should we call it the forest industry? Actually, they mostly just messed up the Forest Service, which sort of trickled down to the forest industry, I guess.
Yeah, that period of time, it's kind of interesting to go through that period and now reflect back on it. At the time, it was pretty painful. But they, you know, as with all industries, there's a retooling, so to speak, every few years when there's new technology. And one of the things that was happening from the 60s through about the early 90s was that industry itself, the sawmills that support the industry, were retooling to small diameter material. And as a result, the departure that we talked about before was accelerated because the target was old growth. You know, I won't back away from that. That is exactly what the target was, but it wasn't nefarious as it's portrayed today. It was because fairly rapidly the remaining old growth on public lands, which is where the bulk of it was left, was not going to physically be able to be broken down into a product. You know, we can make today's assessment on that versus back then, whether that's good or bad, you know, but from an industry standpoint, the Forest Service had to catch up or go the way of the dinosaur with their products. And so as a result, you know, there was a target to old growth, and then the mills were transitioning out of old growth at that time, transitioning into the second growth material, because that was really the bread and butter of the industry that was coming on.
Yeah, you don't see those logs coming down anymore. There's just not.
Yeah, it depends what your definition of old growth is. Some people want to start at 10 inches. You know, I can grow.
Therein lies the problem.
Yeah, well, you know, to a forester, a 10-inch tree is something pretty temporal. But you know, if we're talking, 40 plus, yeah, there's quite a bit of it left in the landscape and protected areas, but, it's not the target of harvest anymore unless it's in the middle of a fire salvage or something like that. Yeah.
Well, the the Al Gore influence of all the tree hugging and all that.
Yeah,
that's kind of gotten us to this fireplace.
Well, it's really thrown some monkey wrenches in the works. At the time, like I say, with this old growth thing, there was something called the War in the Woods, and it was using the spotted owl to shut down the industry, basically.
Which, and that worked out well.
Yeah, it precipitated the Northwest Forest Plan, for which Bill Clinton put five principles in place. None of them have come to fruition. One of the big things that was known as the Grand Compromise was we're going to intensively manage a certain subset of the landscape, intensively, and the rest of it would be in reserves.
So what does that mean?
Well, there's something called matrix lands, which had some old growth on it. It was supposed to be clear-cut and then managed even-aged management. That was kind of an antiquated thought at the time already, because we'd moved beyond all clear-cutting to something else. But that's what the plan was predicated on. And it was, you know, like some of the districts on the Klamath National Forest, the Salmon River District, that's only 3% of the landscape.
Oh, wow.
You know, and Scott River, one of the higher industrial landscapes, was around 15%. So in general, it was much reduced from where the agency was before, which didn't say that commercial activity couldn't occur on the rest of the landscape. It just had to be subordinate to whatever it was put there for, owls, fish, something else.
Mm-hmm.
The Grand Compromise didn't work because that was supposed to end litigation.
Oh, well,
yeah.
If that was the goal, well, yeah, I think even my mom knows that didn't work.
That was one of the principles that President Clinton set forth, and actually it accelerated the litigation from that point on. The other insertion that the FEMAT team that put the Northwest Forest Plan together didn't really put into their final report was something called Survey and Manage. And Survey and Manage was an Al Gore thing. And it was largely an inventory and analysis of everything we didn't know anything about. Invertebrates, vertebrates, all kinds of critters on the landscape, even fungi and things like that.
So they're supposed to walk around and literally make like a catalog of what was there?
Yeah, and in some cases on some of these species, the protocols are such that you have to spend a certain number of hours on a particular size of a landscape to be able to determine its presence or not.
What?
Yeah, it's they're pretty convoluted. There's I don't know, there's several hundred
you
species.
Literally have to stand around in part of the forest
for a period
of time
and move things around and observe
to see if there's anything there you didn't know about before.
Yeah.
Wow. What's that job called? All the things I could think of actually would get me beeped on the air.
Survey crews.
Oh, survey crews. Yeah, that's much nicer. We can say that on the air.
But you know, I don't know the current cost of that. But
if they're just standing around moving rocks,
yeah.
Like, what kind of time? What are we talking? 5 minutes or 5 years?
Well, actually, it depends on the species. If you're blessed with some of the species, sometimes it's a 2-year protocol.
Like salamanders or something? What are we talking about?
Well, some of the snails.
Snails?
Yeah. You have to look in two seasons. And the owls, you know, depending on...
So while this is happening, meanwhile, mm-hmm. like back at the ranch, nobody's doing anything there. This whole area is just like locked down.
Well, what it did is it put into place something similar to the Endangered Species Act for species that aren't endangered.
Yeah.
And so it's it really encumbered the working philosophy of the matrix lands that were to support that $8.5 million to like Siskiyou County with the outputs.
Wow.
And it, of course, with you know, if you're looking for 30 species, and each species has to have a certain protocol. And a certain paperwork filled out specifically for it. It just
and you got to stare at it for 2 years.
It was a minefield of litigation.
Oh yeah.
You know.
So how do we get rid of that?
Well, repeal of Survey and Manage is in the new bill.
Really, the 2647?
Yeah, the 2647. I saw that if AFRC is correct, it was.
What's AFRC again?
American Forest Resource Council.
There you go.
Sent out a newsletter, and it looked like it was maybe a floor addition once that bill reached the floor.
Nice.
I'm sorry to say I didn't think of that one, but it's, you know,
good idea though, huh?
It's brilliant because you know, we already have those protections for those species. It's called the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah, right. So we can't have like the Endangered Species Act and then the act that sort of looks for endangered species but doesn't call them that yet. I mean, what the heck?
Yeah, it's ESA, the son of ESA, I guess.
Son of ESA. Hey, it was Shark Week last week. Yeah, what do we have? Son of? Oh no, we have Bride of Jaws.
Bride of Jaws.
We always thought Shark Week was stupid, and then we watched it once, and it's like, ooh, actually, Shark Week's pretty fun.
Yeah, you know, the whole premise of the thing.
Bride of Endangered Species. What the heck?
The whole premise may have been good to sense how many of these critters we had, but if you're only looking in places you harvest and you're not harvesting that much, you're never really going to know.
You're never going to impact them.
Exactly.
So what do you?
Well, and you're really never going to know what the population is across the landscape because you're only looking in certain places.
God. Okay. So.
Well, the Endangered Species Act now is really, I think,
it's
mostly used.
It's a hammer. It's not
exactly.
Yeah.
It's not about this.
So,
critters.
How many people in the Forest Service are jammed up doing this kind of stuff versus doing things that are useful that the public might actually care about?
I just was curious.
Is like half of them wandering around looking for mushrooms and
large
snails?
Large crews, yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah.
All right, we have to take a break because now we have to bash our heads on the desk, and that's not going to come over well on the radio. Yeah, we have to have a moment. Duh. Anyway, you're listening to We the People Radio. We will be back with you. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Give a damn's busted.
It's like thunder, lightning. The way your love is frightening. I better knock on wood, baby.
And we're back. Knock on wood. I forgot there was a song about that.
If you can find some in here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not really sure. We're surrounded by cords. Hey, okay, so give us that spotted owl deal. Because,
well,
you know, for all you people out there who hate us, and but we're like a car accident, you can't stop listening, you know, because I know there's like the environmental set that just loves to hate us, because they call me periodically, which is how I know that. And so, just in case you're thinking that all these protections are really actually important and they're doing what they say they're doing, and without them, we would be living on a moonscape, let's talk about the spotted owl.
Well, I think they were living on the moon if they don't know what that whole thing was about.
You hater.
I am a hater. I was impacted by that farce.
Yeah, it wasn't everybody who lived up here.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so now how has this obsession with the spotted owl worked out for the spotted owl? Because that was the point.
Well, it hasn't worked out very well. And, you know, obviously there's very little harvesting going on of old growth anymore, as it was in the 80s when the spotted owl habitat was designated. But so if you have looking at the spotted owl population in northern in the Pacific Northwest under the Northwest Forest Plan, after 23 years, the spotted owl numbers continue to decline.
Oh, big shock!
And they're declining at 3% per year on a steady basis, at about a 40% decline over the last 23 years. And you know, logging isn't to blame for that.
Obviously, because we're not doing much.
No, not hardly any at all on public lands. Now, you know, it's different on private land, but they're still under Section 10 consultation under the ESA. But if you look at it, the biggest threat to spotted owls right now is two things, from what my research friends tell me. Number one is the threat of habitat loss from wildfire, and number two is the invasion of the barred owl into its habitat.
And isn't that like a spinoff of the spotted owl, aren't they?
Well, it's a predator.
Cousins or
it's a
neighbors
predator.
Or
I don't know the. I'm not a...
Yeah, me either, yeah, obviously.
I'm not a bird expert.
I just talk crap about them.
Bird expert.
Qualified to do that.
Yeah, you want to talk to me about habitat? I can talk to you all day about that, how to grow it, how to maintain it, how to make it better. But
well, so hugging all the trees, we've got now, you know, just multiple times more trees on the landscape than we had before, mm-hmm. which is getting rid of our meadows. And as mm-hmm. you taught me a long time ago, with no meadows, you don't get any snowpack. So even if you right. get snow, you don't get the you can't hold the historic snowpack
sure.
because it sits on the trees and the bushes, and there's no place for it to pack.
So maybe we should talk about why do we have the fires we have today?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's chat about that.
if you look at the climate cycles,
sure,
if you will,
you mean the ones that God started, not the ones we were
yeah,
doing.
Yeah, and there is a change in climate and. You know, I don't call it climate change, but there's a change in climate because they're cyclic. And if you look at something called the wet period, wet-cool period, which we came out of about the early 90s, came out of that cool wet period. It allowed trees to grow at much greater density and allowed species to exist in places where they normally wouldn't have grown, say, 200 years ago. Largely the true fir component that we see in the mixed conifer at a much higher density. And, you know, the research you've got on the webpage there, you'll see the four times the density as a result of that and cutting practices. But probably more important as well, coupled the same period of time, 1934, the Forest Service issued a letter that made it I don't know if it was criminal at the time, but an offense anyway to do range burning. And so that ended the previous, like in Siskiyou County, the previous 8,000 years of Native American burning.
That was in 1934?
1934.
Okay.
And then from about the Gold Rush era to 1934 was practiced by the range folks, you know, at the end of every season. So that was a cessation. If you look at the photo record from then to present, you'll see an explosion of trees beginning in about 1945, so about a 10-year period in the photo record. That coupled with the thinning from below now, what we've done is we've created a clone of trees across the landscape. We talked about the elimination of old growth.
Right.
Well, in doing so, what you end up doing is having very dense stands of second growth trees. And at the very time that they needed to be managed the most is when the industry was shut down on public lands. So you have very high densities of second growth trees with a much higher water demand than their old growth counterparts across the landscape at an even aged with intertwined, interlocking canopy that is predisposed to fire because we're coming out of a wet period. And we're artificially
sure.
densified, if you will, and predisposed to the fires we see today. Now,
So if we were gonna, like, if you were gonna actually plan to mm-hmm. have catastrophic wildfire,
yeah,
we totally did that.
We did it.
Yeah,
we did it.
We're all plugged in, ready to go.
Yeah.
We've achieved our goal.
So we have a predisposed landscape that during a drought, it's going to happen. It's physics.
Sure. And so for all those people that think, well, fire's a natural part of the landscape, and we should just let them run because it actually helps the forest.
Well, it is natural. And having taught ecology, I'll tell you that it is, but only if it's within the natural range of variability. And
what does that mean?
Well, what that means is you can't have...
Dr. Halp, what does that mean?
You can't have natural fire in a artificial landscape. Because
it was supposed to, like, rip through and get rid of some of the grass underneath and the underbrush and some of the bushes and, you know, burn a little bark off, but not like, turn the whole place into gray dust.
If you look at Eric Knapp's research and what he's done is reconstructed the growth plots of Duncan Dunning from 1922 to 1935, I think, is when those were done in the Sierra Nevada. What you'll see is that what once had a variable carpet, if you will, of 25% openness
mm-hmm.
In the stand. Now, it's all grown up to the same level now, and it's all filled in. So what, you know, the 25% openness is critical to both water yield, from the standpoint of being able to pack snow in small openings, so that you have longer periods of release during the year and higher
sure.
flows in the summer, as well as it's a great behavior modifier for fire.
Sure, because it gives little gaps where the
fire has to drop to the floor
sure.
instead of running through the landscape and killing everything in its process. So we have historically on the, like the fire studies in the Klamath National Forest and working with Carl Skinner, you know, you'll see a landscape that was 25% stand replacing historically, but that stand replacing was generally in the upper third of the landscape and not in the lower two-thirds of it. But now what you'll see is from valley floor all the way to ridgetop, you'll see 100% high-severity fire and complete mortality. And as a result of both drought, past cutting practices, lack of management, and fires just running.
And so with no management, the other thing we have to contend with that people have commented on, like in the chat room, and the thing we see all the time is the dead and dying trees.
Right.
So you have all this down timber in packed stands,
right.
which just creates, I mean, hey, anybody who's ever built a fire
yeah.
knows you take dry,
yeah.
you know, little brushy stuff.
There's two other components of that are really critical that most people miss. Number one is, in order for a fire to move through a forest without the destructive nature of it, it has to have canopies that are not interlocked. Because when we practice prescribed fire and things like that, we look at venting.
Oh.
And, you know, it's if you have a landscape where all your trees have interconnected crowns and a fire does run through it, it suppresses the heat below the canopy and cooks the trees.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
So there's...
That makes sense.
Yeah. yeah.
There's that aspect there in fire behavior and in a pre-condition as well. Some other research coming out, too, is the ozone effects on forests are retarding the opening of stomata. Stomata where the tree... expires, it's like your pore in your skin.
Okay.
Allows air and water in and out. But during high periods of heat during the day, the stomata have to close to keep the tree from dehydrating. Increased exposures in ozone from the research in Dr. Golke will show you that just a minor exposure like we see on the prevailing wind of a city will stop the stoma from closing for 48 hours. So what's that do? It leads to a freeze-dried, if you will, effect mm-hmm. of the vegetation on the landscape, another predisposed effect of lack of forest management and air pollution.
Wow. I did not know that.
Oh, that's interesting.
So we're
getting really good at managing fire.
Yeah, I mean, we're...
Well, maybe. I don't know if we're getting good at managing fire. We're getting good at spending a lot of money managing fire.
And when we come back, we have to revisit Spotted Owl.
Okay.
Just we have to revisit it quickly when we come back, but we need to take a really swift break. And you are listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I can.
We decided on the break we could see the forest for the trees. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. I will have the archive up shortly for those of you who missed the first half. But, okay, little side note on the spotted owl and the barred owl, B-A-R-R-E-D. We have a commenter in the chat room who said that they are virtually indistinguishable. We've decided none of us are actually qualified to give some sort of a dissertation on that. But bottom line is, they're close They are close enough, and I have heard they're interbreeding.
Yeah, I know.
Which makes it a little bit bizarre that we're shooting the barred owls to save the spotted owls when they're interbreeding, because that would make them, anyway.
Yeah.
Biologists know best, though.
Exactly. So
they're going to fix it.
We've gone somewhere stupid with that.
I don't really want my grandkids to be robbed of the opportunity to see a purebred spotted owl. I mean, that's just wrong.
Or eat one. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no.
I heard they taste like chicken. Okay, back to the fire thing. What else didn't we, because we're here in our last half hour. It goes really fast, huh?
Yeah.
What are we missing? We talked about what about this national, you hear about it all the time, the NEPA and all that stuff, the National Environmental Policy Act.
Yeah.
And that just makes everything take 1,000 times longer. It is a...
It can. It doesn't have to, but it can.
It is a process. It's a process. I mean, it's a rule, but it's a process that they have to go through before they do anything on the forest.
Yeah.
And isn't that where the lawsuits all come in and all that?
Sure. Prior to 1973 or 4, my memory's escaping me, one of those 2 years when it was signed, the agency was largely engineers and foresters. That was it. We had some clerical folks, a few other miscellaneous disciplines, but the forest was ruled and, not ruled, but I mean, all the policy was written by and governed by that which foresters and engineers put together.
Mm-hmm.
The National Environmental Policy Act required an interdisciplinary team to have other resource disciplines come into the mix in the analysis of projects. And, we're kind of centered on vegetation projects here, timber projects, that kind of thing, but it pertains to anything. It really, if you're, any commitment of federal money for any program triggers NEPA.
Oh, wow. So you're tangled in that to do anything.
Anything, yeah. And, we complain at the Forest Service, but the military really has its issues with it as well. But it's put together as a supposedly a hard look at what you were doing, rather than a too disciplined look at what the effects might be. And I guess from my perspective, if the litigation I've been involved in was actually an effect that was occurring, I'd feel differently than if it were just an administrative challenge through the, what was analyzed and how, outcome not being detrimental to the environment, but maybe, like we talked about, survey and manage. I know of a lawsuit, the ONRC lawsuit from years ago. Part of that was because my predecessor on the district filled a form out wrong.
Nice.
So that's how that stuff gets interjected. So the NEPA process has public disclosure periods.
And it was supposed to take into account people.
Yeah.
I mean, it was supposed to be about people, and now it's almost
It was about the public's voice. And it was really clearly put together to disclose to the average person what was going on. It was not to pander to special interests. Which is largely what rule NEPA today and push it around because of litigation.
Mm-hmm.
And for the agency to come to a objective opinion about the effects of a project that was about to be implemented, and an informing consent kind of a thing with the public.
So if somebody who asked, categorical exclusions can be exempt to full NEPA.
They can.
Is that correct?
If the court would stop taking them away. Categorical exemptions are determined by the secretary under certain circumstances.
So what would be an example of one?
You drive down a road, you see a snag. You see three or four snags that are leaning over the road. You cut them down. You know what the effect of cutting that tree down is. Rather than going,
it's not going to fall on the street.
it's
not going to kill anyone.
There's really no environmental effect associated with that. So
right.
A CE is an exercise where it's an abbreviated form. You have to do. You still have to do analysis. You still have to do the ESA consultation piece.
What does that mean?
Well, What do you mean?
You got to call a guy who can come and sit there for 2 weeks and look for snails?
Still, yeah, well, study.
Are we talking about the snail guy?
Oh, yeah.
Back to the snail guy.
Oh, yeah,
God,
back to that.
That's America.
Oh. You have to, if you're, you have to do owl surveys unless you do this, that activity outside the operating, outside of the limited operating period. Which
if
is
it's
like,
a tree hanging over the street,
yeah,
over a road?
If it's done commercially, yes. Yeah. If you just cut it down, no. From a public safety hazard. But if you remove it and sell it, yes, then you have to go through the process. So the difference is, under the CE, you initially couldn't appeal them.
Categorical exemption?
Yeah, you can now, according to the courts.
So as soon as you file it, what, Center for Biological Diversity?
Yeah,
and
somebody.
These other guys, they come swooping in?
They can, yeah. And like I say, they were designed for routine activity that had virtually no effect.
Right.
And but unfortunately, you can make money on those. And
if you sue.
Yeah, there's been several authorities given back to the agency since the mid 90s. The Bush administration did it at least once, maybe two times, if my memory is correct, and both times within. About a period of 2 months, the agency was sued, and the courts took that authority away again. It's just, like I say, it's an abbreviated process to do routine things in a timely manner.
But it doesn't sound like it's timely anymore.
Not if you have to go to NEPA, because it takes at least a year to get through an environmental assessment.
Good Lord.
At least a year.
And no wonder nothing gets done. So
yeah,
we've basically taken, I mean, as far as, like, if you just want to look at what?
I know what we didn't talk about.
What didn't we talk about?
The effects of litigation on the budget.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty important. You know,
yeah.
It seems like a big deal.
Well, folks get pretty frustrated with the fact that, why do you listen to these people? You know, they're going to sue you anyway, that kind of thing. You hear that all the time. I did anyway while I was working. Well, the fact of the matter is, in the early 2000s, when we talked about the budget being migrated upward. Well, when that happened, prior to that time, the Washington office mainly handled all the litigation costs for the agency as a line item in the national budget. You know,
right? And you guys handled,
we handled getting the job done.
Yeah, yeah. You handled managing the land and all that and the budget for that.
Yeah. Now, what's happened in recent years is that that cost of that litigation now comes out of the project funds to do project work. At the field
level. So that could be maintaining roads,
or
campgrounds.
Or a future timber sale, or any service to the public. So
so it basically stops it before it even gets started in a lot of cases, doesn't it?
Well, but what it does is it's a disincentive to do anything other than whoever it is who's legally pushing you around. Because you end up...
if you don't do what they want, then you lose basically all your money.
Yeah, and you have part of your workforce unfunded, and you can't deliver the target or the services to the American public because it's coming directly out of your project funds.
So it comes out of... Okay, so if you, as a ranger, if you basically do whatever the environmentalists want you to do, which isn't even possible, but let's just pretend, if you did and your district didn't get sued at all, do you have more project funds?
You would, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ah, so that does kind of explain, there is kind of an incentive then.
Yeah, and it explains some of the wacky decisions and, some of the, the legal dance that goes on and that kind of thing.
But if they don't, Then they can't do the things that the public wants because it comes off their budget from their forest.
Yeah, but see, the public really doesn't have a hammer. The courts do.
Right, but the public doesn't understand.
Right.
I mean, why the forest isn't providing certain things,
sure.
But they may not be able to.
Yeah.
And then how about the fire budget? So if your forest has a giant fire, does the fire budget come out of some magical printing press?
Well, that's
the taxpayer, or does it come out of your forest budget too?
We can talk about that at several levels. Let's talk about the appropriation level. So, my congressman's been fighting back and forth and on the fire borrowing,
yes,
that occurs, and with the budget being eaten alive by fire suppression funds, what happens is when the agency runs out of money at the national level to fight fire, they take it out of project funds. Well, that'd be okay if everybody were a firefighter, but they're not. So you have biologists and foresters that are actually working on service to the American public that now all of a sudden they're what they're doing is preempted.
Okay.
And so we put them into service and support functions in fire to pay their salary because they can't work on the projects they were working on before because that was taken for fire. And this, of course, this always happens in the summer. And you know, the fiscal year ends in at the end of September, and the new one starts October 1st. And the fire borrowing is always in the fourth quarter, which is beginning in June, which is also where the agency delivers all of its targets. So instantly when the fire borrowing occurs, there often is an offset of what should have been delivered that year because of no budget to deliver it. So you further ratchet down the outputs that were agreed to both at the congressional level and with the public in an offset there. That's why some have been advocating, like myself, that there has to be some firewall, if you will, between project delivery funds and fire suppression funds to protect the actual goods and services going to the American public.
So does the fire budget that include funds for prevention, or is that just firefighting?
This would be under an emergency code. It would be firefighting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's turned, I mean, it's really taken the timber industry and turned it into a fire industry.
Sure.
Because you have a lot of a lot of the fires back in the olden days that we actually lived in,
yeah.
The fires were initially fought by people working in the woods.
Yeah, and that's really important to know, too. And the fire response thing, people are frustrated that the agency doesn't catch these fires. Well, there's a lot of reasons for that. In reality, they do catch about 98% of them. They caught a much higher degree of those back earlier, primarily because early in my career, there was a logging crew putting the fire out before the fire crew got
exactly.
there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, and they'd get on the radio and radio down that there was a fire.
Right.
And now, we're decommissioning all these roads and making it impossible to get there. So even if you knew there was a fire, it's super hard to get there.
And there's nobody in the woods like there was back then, to speak of.
Now, what about the fire towers? I've got a question in here. Are they decommissioning those?
Locally, we have quite a few of them. All the ones that are efficient are still staffed.
Mm-hmm.
There were some old ones that didn't see much of the area that they got rid of.
Bill and I used to hang out at the fire tower.
South
Fork.
South Fork.
I guess regarding these 98% that are caught, if you take a woods crew that's nearby and they're on that fire in 15, 20 minutes versus an engine remotely located, it takes 3 hours to get to that fire.
Oh, yeah.
You can pretty quickly see how big a fire can get before an actual crew gets on top of that thing.
Well, there's always the big thing that they let them go, that they watch them and don't actually jump to put them out right away, and then all of a sudden Happy Camp nearly burns down and everybody's mad.
Yeah.
I don't think, I think as long as we continue to let the forest overgrow and be this perfect habitat for fire, I think the public is going to continue to be mad because we're going to continue to have massive fires.
Sure.
We're like setting ourselves up for failure if we think that the fire thing isn't going to be happening. We'll always have lightning and stuff. Bob, how are we situated? Should we take our last swift break? You believe it? We've had you hostage in here for 2 hours. You didn't even know it, did you? It was pretty quick. Oh, you're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back. Oh. Well, here's a classic. Bill's got his white pants on. Swing it, Bill.
John Travolta rocks.
Oh, dude.
You're gonna burn.
that part. I was like, where are we going? Who is that?
The Crazy World of Arthur Broughton.
I remember that part right there. Not the video, though. Oh, the video is disturbing. Don't look that up. We're not putting a link to that on the website. Wow. But you know, it is kind of funny. Fairly bad special effects. If you want to look back at how bad special effects used to be.
Really bad.
Look up that video then. Okay. So, Equal Access to Justice Act.
Mm-hmm.
Originally started, good idea. Now it allows all the environmental groups to just, you know, sue the crap out of the Forest Service, and therefore nothing gets done. It sucks out all the budget, so they can't do the things that that would benefit the public.
Complicates the process.
Yeah, fouls it up. Okay, so dealing with that would be a good thing going forward. Sure. What else would be useful?
Well, you brought up I brought up Survey and Manage, mm-hmm. under the Northwest Forest Plan for us, and that's basically everything from Clear Lake, mm-hmm. All the way to the Canadian border, the Spotted Owl Forest. Survey and Manage piece.
How do we get rid of the whole Spotted Owl thing? Can't we be done with it? I mean, if we're killing them and there's fewer now than before, now we really have to have the Spotted Owl thing? Or it's been a self-fulfilling prophecy? Or how long does... Like, if it's an endangered species, is it just there forever, mostly?
Pretty much.
Yeah. Okay, that's what I figured.
Yeah. I don't know. You work for a congressman. Maybe you can...
I'll go fix that. In my free time, we'll go handle that.
But it is an interesting thing in that a lot of the impetus for the enactment of the Endangered Species Act was actually to address, and I've done some research on this and taught it in school, is that... It was put in place because in the 60s there were a lot of expiring treaties, international treaties on whaling. And the United States came up with part of the Endangered Species Act was to protect those species within our waters with a new set of legal things.
Well, go figure.
Yeah.
And that went wrong on us, too.
Yeah.
You know, every good idea is great until somebody else gets a hold of it and then...
No good deed goes undone.
Yeah, strangles the life out of it.
Yeah.
Somebody, so, in our last 5 minutes, what are we missing?
the big, I guess the part that I didn't get to talk about was a little bit about the fire itself, good fire, bad fire.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of thing. Maybe I can address that a little bit. The from an ecology standpoint, what we look at is we look at two forms of something called succession. Succession is started when a plant community is knocked back, so to speak.
Okay.
Hit with a punch. We call them disturbance regimes where we have fire. Some of them, like near the coast, are wind-driven systems that blow down trees. But it's a revitalization or a cyclic thing that happens in the natural world to enrich nutrients and recruit younger plants and start things over. when things are out of whack and you go above what we talked about, the 25% early seral in the forest, and you get whole landscapes, what you end up with is something in ecology called primary succession. In other words, if you have secondary succession, which is what we're always trying to do with forestry, mimicking our disturbance regimes like fire,
mm-hmm.
You give it a little punch, and within 20 years, it recovers to what it was before. That's the whole mm-hmm. goal of modern forest science,
mm-hmm.
And that's a productive ecosystem. If you hit an ecosystem, say with fire, and it goes back several seral stages, like to rocks, and then have to grass forbs and then brush and then trees again.
Right.
That's outside the range of variability.
And that's what the environmentalists now think is fabulous. You were on that tour and they were looking at gray, scorched earth, thinking that this was beautiful and it'll come back.
And that's only normal in 25% of the landscape. And in the upper third, according to the research in historically on the Klamath National Forest, and that's real similar to the rest of the Sierra as well. So when you get things that are 80% of the landscape or 80% of a burn, that are that's outside what nature would have normally done
to just scorch it down to nothing.
Yeah, you have other things at play when that happens. So at that point, your seed source is so far away, you don't get the you know, you don't get the revitalization. You have such a degradation, including, you know, I will say, too, the one effect that in the secondary succession is you still leave the soil intact. In the primary succession, those are typically reserved for, like, volcanic events and those kinds of things where you have complete destruction of all the flora and fauna in the soil itself.
Well, speaking of that, there was an article in Range Magazine.
Speaking of flora and fauna?
Yeah.
Huh?
Range Magazine did an article on Mount St. Helens and showed the contrast between Forest Service land that was they didn't go back in and replant and manage versus Weyerhaeuser land that they went in and replant. Yeah. And they're already harvesting that ground. And when you look at the aerial photographs of the difference, and there's a line. It's amazing.
Maybe we can talk about that someday because I worked there during the eruption.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'd love to. People have already said you need to come back because there's a ton of more stuff to talk about. So, so Pat will have to come shop again, and you'll have to come back and hang out with us.
I should have taken my 17-week forest ecology class.
I should have. This stuff's interesting, and there's a lot of it.
Oh yeah, there's so much to talk about on this one. We need to have Ray back,
and especially as the summer wears on, you know, and the fires come and all that. So thank you very much.
You're welcome
for popping in with us.
Happy to be here.
And thanks for listening. You've caught another episode of We the People Radio, and we will have your archive up in about 20 minutes. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.